Well, what if everything you've heard about the Oklahoma City bombing has all been a lie? The narrative that the powers that be want you to believe on what unfolded on that fateful morning in Oklahoma City. Our next guest is an investigative journalist, Derek Brose. He has a new series of documentaries called The Pyramid of Power, which is examining all of those individuals who are working behind the scenes that actually control us. We talk about the deep state. But who are these people and how exactly are they controlling us? Today, I specifically wanted to talk about a big piece of his documentary, the Oklahoma City bombing, because I think this is a narrative, this is a story that many of you probably don't know. And so we decided to welcome Derek here on the show to have a deep dive discussion about this. Derek, welcome into Redacted. Great to see you.
Yeah, thank you for having me back, Clayton.
Welcome. Yeah, welcome back here. And you've been doing some amazing work. Before we get into Oklahoma City specifically, can you tell our audience about the series of videos that you've been putting together, the series of documentary videos? And you can visit the pyramidofpower.net, which is the website, to see all of the videos in sequence. I have to say, I watched your episode on false flags and was just blown away by it. So how did this idea come about?
Yeah, thank you for that, Clayton. So originally the idea for this was a two and a half hour presentation I was giving as I was doing talks across the United States back in 2018. And after doing a few dozen of those, I realized that it probably wasn't the best format for such information, that I could maybe do it better in a documentary style presentation. And so that's what I started focusing on in 2021. We began the series. It's myself. I do the research, the writing of the scripts, the narration, and I work with some really talented editors who make it come to life. And the idea was that each episode, in terms of the documentary specifically, each episode would aim to be 30 minutes or less, so we could kind of make it for the, you know, the Netflix generation, make it bingeable. And if you get sucked into one, maybe you watch the whole series and by the end of it, you know, your whole worldview is shifted. And so every episode's 30 minutes or less, at least that's what we aim for. A few have gone over, and packed with the best information that already exists. As you probably know, there's a lot of amazing documentaries and books out there that sometimes you don't have to recreate the wheel for a certain topic. So I would use my own original research plus sourcing from pre-existing documentaries, pre-existing books, condensing it down to, just the facts that people need to know to get them thinking about these topics. And then every episode also ends with suggested solutions for each different topic, and then recommended reading, recommended watching for those who want to go deeper into their journey. And so this latest one is chapter 14, the false flag deception. So we've been working on it now for 3 years, and there's going to be 17 episodes in total. The final episode 17 will answer the question, who or what is at the top of the pyramid, where I will continue to interview different researchers and journalists. In this one, false flag deception, we feature some discussion with G. Edward Griffin, who's of course longtime researcher, been doing this since the 1950s. And I have a lot of other people, Whitney Webb and others, featured in previous episodes. And so that final episode, we're going to try to see, what does everybody think is at the top? Who is at the top? And of course, I will offer my own view. But the whole goal is, this is just meant to be a way to wake people up in another, you know, fashion. Because some folks will watch 3 hour conversations. Some folks will, you know, watch a 5 hour documentary or read a 500-page book. But some won't. They'd rather it be packaged in a format that's a half hour or less. And that's really what I was aiming for with this.
Well, great work on this. And so today I really wanted to dive deep into Oklahoma City. Now, this is I remember where I was on that particular morning. I think a lot of Americans do. They have an awareness about whether maybe their teacher came into the classroom that day and told them what just unfolded. You learned about it. And we were all told a certain story about what happened on that fateful morning in Oklahoma City, the narrative that we were all told that the mainstream media ran with. And maybe you can paint a picture. What are we, before we get into your work on this, what is the narrative that we were all told? Like, what is the sort of, maybe I could say, fabricated version of events that we've all swallowed and been told, and maybe even, you know, makes up many Wikipedia pages?
Yeah, absolutely. So the official government version of events says that on April 19th, 1995, at about 9:02 a.m., Timothy McVeigh, who is former military veteran, white supremacist, white nationalist, him acting alone with maybe one or two conspirators that the mainstream will admit, killed 168 people, including children, at the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. The story is that he parked a moving truck fertilizer bomb, and he parked it on the outside of the building and, you know, blew up the whole front face of the building. And as I said, killed over 150 people. He was caught shortly after and eventually put to death. That is sort of encapsulates the mainstream version of events. And just to kind of put this into context for, because I was about 11 years old when this happened, so I don't remember it too well. I do remember headlines, but I remember 9/11 6 years later a lot more clearly. And to kind of put it in that context, this was one of the building up of promoting the idea that there is a rise in domestic extremism. There was much talk in the 90s about the militia movement. It's on the rise. And then, of course, 6 years later, you had the 9/11 attacks. And as I talk about in the documentary, current president and then Senator Joe Biden was part of passing this anti-terrorism, domestic terrorism bill right after the Oklahoma City bombing happened. And similar to after 9/11, we saw the Patriot Act. Joe Biden still claims credit for having written this bill and basically saying it was the basis for what would become the Patriot Act. So looking back, so we're in the 29th year now. Next year, next April, will be 30 years since this happened. We can see how that conversation has advanced, and there's continuing to be talking points from the corporate media saying that regular everyday Americans might be the next Timothy McVeigh or Osama bin Laden, et cetera. So much of the propaganda we see today traces back.
Right. And it all is traced back to that. In fact, that is the moment I recall. I mean, after that morning, after that happened, I think it was in social studies class, Mr. Vogt, my high school history teacher and social studies teacher, and the guy that made me fall in love with history, I remember him coming in and very somberly telling us what happened and explaining to us what he knew had happened at that time. And I remember that was the moment, of course, we would hear in biographies written about Bill Clinton, that was the moment that he really became president of the United States. It was this idea, sort of his challenger moment, when the challenger blows up and President Reagan soothes an upset nation. And this was the thing, right? Bill Clinton becomes president. He soothes an upset nation. He vows to make us safe. He vows to protect us against these types of attacks, both foreign and domestic. And then, of course, we see the gestation of what you point out as the Patriot Act here. So that's the official story of events. So that's the official narrative that we heard. But you started to peel back this onion in your research, and of course, a lot of great information out there now that we've been able to see through declassified information and others. What do we know actually happened that day that hasn't been told to us, that has been kept from us?
Well, there's definitely a few things right off the bat. So one thing that I think the public is completely unaware of, or I would say most of the public, especially outside of Oklahoma City and that area, is that there were citizens, just regular everyday people, who had questions about this event. Immediately from the beginning, there were people saying something's not lining up here. Those include a now deceased police officer, Terry Yakey. We can talk about him. But also representatives. There is a man named Charles Key, who is a former Republican member of the Oklahoma House of Representatives. He served two, maybe three different terms. And when this happened, he started working with some of the family members who had children deceased. So the blast was targeting not only the federal building, but specifically the daycare center at the federal building. And so unfortunately, there were quite a bit of children who were killed in this blast. Some of those parents, including this man, Glenn Wilburn, did not believe or had questions about the way things happened and were immediately suspicious about the true causes of it. They started working with Charles Key, this former representative, and they spent 18 months talking to more than 170 different witnesses. And they basically formed what became a grand jury, a citizen's grand jury. And their conclusion, this is their own word, said, quote, "We cannot affirmatively state that absolutely no one else was involved in the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building." And so this was kind of opening the doors to maybe we haven't got the full story. And some of these people are still to this day out there trying to raise awareness about this. The other major thing I would say that pokes holes in the official story, much like the 9/11 story, is that there have now been forensic experts and explosive experts who've looked at the building and the way that it was exploded. It appears to be exploding from the inside, not from a truck outside blowing inwards. And of course, that would indicate that there may have been explosives inside the building. And of course, that would indicate pre-planning, access to the building, things that, as far as we're told, Timothy McVeigh never had access to. So that opens up all kinds of questions about, did he have these other co-conspirators with somebody within the building? There's other things like federal agents saying publicly that they received text messages to not go to work that day, which is also a similar thing people have said about 9/11. So there appears to have been some level of foreknowledge within some level of the federal government. I don't claim to know who, but somebody knew something was going to happen, and the message was passed along to certain agents who were told not to go to the work that day, which obviously indicates prior knowledge. So those two things alone, like the blast pattern, advanced warnings, those sort of were the beginning of the larger investigation, which then gets into Officer Terry Yakey, gets into these co-conspirators related to Timothy McVeigh and why none of them are ever brought up into the conversation. I think he has Terry Nichols is the only other one that was publicly admitted to, and he got a smaller sentence. I don't think he was put to death, but there are even more people beyond that. There's video of Timothy McVeigh getting out of the Ryder truck. So he was on site. We know that for sure. And other people leaving with him, a man in a hat, a ball cap that there's pictures of. There was witnesses getting pictures drawn of him that were in the news beginning. But right after the first couple days, the story starts shifting, and all of a sudden it's all focused on Timothy McVeigh. Again, much like the 9/11, where in the beginning there's a lot of conversations about bombs in the buildings, et cetera, and then it's all Osama bin Laden. We saw a very similar shift in the media after the first couple days of certain questions coming out and making it to the surface. The narrative was then kind of narrowed down to just Timothy McVeigh.
It's remarkable, isn't it, how this happens, right? There was a lot of individuals, of course, on 9/11 who were speaking to cameras, speaking to news cameras, saying, we heard the explosions. We saw they were clearing people out because they knew that explosions were happening. And that stuff just like disappears, absolutely disappears. You, as you point out in your piece, the news narrative, the local news stations, were also asking the same thing. There's eyewitnesses, there's other individuals, it seemed like there was more than one person. It was more than just just Timothy McVeigh. And then suddenly, overnight, miraculously, all of those news stations just changed their story. And they all followed one similar narrative, except for one news station, which kept on, I think Channel 4 in Oklahoma City actually kept on the story. But it is remarkable. Do we know who spoke to them? Do we have any information as to who might have reached out to those local news stations to saying, here's the story, don't make people panic about other individuals, it's just Timothy McVeigh?
As far as like U.S. government officials who were perpetuating that narrative?
Yeah, or who anyone who might have reached out to these news directors of these news stations to make them change their story?
I don't personally have any direct knowledge of who was involved in that, but I mean, we need to look at, of course, at the time Bill Clinton was president, you had, I think it was Ashcroft was the head of the FBI at the time, maybe still in there, if not him, his predecessor. So I would look at those departments, because as you mentioned a moment ago, on the local level, as these things often work out, you get real journalism. There's some level of real journalism, especially back in 1995, people actually asking questions, talking to local people, but then the narrative starts to form on the national level. So on the local level, there are still people, as I mentioned, like Charles Key, I believe he's still alive and he still will speak publicly about this. Another man named Hoppe Heidelberg, who was part of the grand jury. We include some of his testimony in the documentary. So there are folks on the other side who are still trying to raise awareness. Now, the only person I know who is or official department that has been named as somebody trying to hush the story up would be the Oklahoma City Police Department as well, because as we discussed with Officer Terry Yakey, he immediately had questions and just didn't feel like he was getting the full story. And as his wife and his sister, who are still living, tell it, he apparently filed a report with the Oklahoma City Police Department where he outlined all the discrepancies he was finding, and he was told to refile his report. That, like, you know, we're not taking this one. You need to refile it and do a brand new one. Otherwise, you're going to face trouble. And his ex-wife also tells a story of going to visit the building afterwards a couple days, because he specifically wanted to look at the bottom of the building, like where the daycare center was. It seems that he had suspicions that there were bombs inside the building. And so he was, according to his still living wife and sister, was being threatened by people within the Oklahoma City Police Department. I don't know if they know exact names. They've never said specifically like Sergeant so-and-so. And I don't think Terry ever publicly said. Unfortunately, he ended up allegedly killing himself in a very brutal way, slicing his wrist dozens of times and had bruises all over his feet, and his body was badly beaten. And at the same time also allegedly killed himself with a gun.
clearly under pressure. And then he went back the night of the bombing to, he examined the building, if I'm not mistaken, and he was met by the FBI. He went back because something didn't look right to him, and he wanted to investigate the blast pattern, which he believed came from inside the building outwards, not outside in, as in the case of a fertilizer truck hitting the building. And he was met with the FBI that told him to turn around, get out of here, right?
Absolutely. This is what his wife and his sister, again, they're still alive, so they've shared these stories publicly. And as I talk about in the documentary, just as recent as last year, CNN actually surprisingly did a piece on this and said, you know, why was this cop killed? Even acknowledging that these discrepancies still exist in the story and that still to this day, his family hasn't gotten any answers. Does that police report he wrote still exist somewhere in OKCPD files? You know, is that potentially feasible? Who was the agent or agents who turned him away from the building and told him, get out of here? We don't have the answers to these questions. His wife and his sister said they believe it was an FBI agent or somebody from the DOJ, but they never got a name. They didn't get a badge number, et cetera. So unfortunately, we're 30 years after the fact, and some of these answers may be lost to the pages, to the, you know, history. But we do know for certain that there are so many holes in the official story of the Oklahoma City bombing that what they've told us is just not possible.
And not possible that it was just a singular truck filled with fertilizer explosives that could have brought down this building and killed 168 people. That all sorts of munitions experts have looked at this and studied how much fertilizer. It's basically impossible. Am I wrong? Is there any chance that this could have been that could totally have happened? That it was just a boxcar filled with fertilizer, and that's what brought down this entire building.
There is strong evidence that demolition charges were in the building. So I think that at this point, again, we don't know. That evidence has been long taken away and wiped away. But anybody who understands demolition and looks at the building and the blast pattern, it does not seem to indicate something coming from outside going inwards. And there may have been, it appears, where unfortunately directly in the daycare center. The daycare center of the building, from what I've learned, was kind of in the basement or the lower levels. So the children may have faced direct impacts from, if there were charges inside the building, they probably were there at the basement with the kids.
Can you imagine the sick individuals that are laying these charges ahead of time and knowing where they're laying them, and they know that they're inside of a child's daycare center at the federal building? It's
this might seem kind of fantastical for some folks in the audience who are maybe newer to these ideas, but there's so much compartmentalization. There's so much layers within the U.S. government that we as average citizens without top secret access, et cetera, do not know about. And there are military soldiers, highly trained special forces that go out and commit operations. And it could be something like this. They may not even be aware of what they're doing. Now, of course, we could imagine if your task for the day is to go put charges in a federal government building, you might have some questions. But these are, of course, the highly trained, highly obedient officers and soldiers who are part of these elite forces. And I don't think they're going to be coming out speaking publicly anytime soon. There's also, I should say, that there are some theories that Timothy McVeigh was a patsy in the sense that he didn't even know what he was participating. This is one of the things that many of us who study false flags suspect, that sometimes these operations may have, at least the people involved in them may have believed they were training exercises, and then these training exercises go live. And so, for example, maybe Timothy McVeigh and others thought they were participating in a drill, and then the explosion happens, and the next thing he knows, he's being plastered all over TV as this is the guy behind it, and he never got to speak up about it. He did not fully confess to saying that he was involved in this, but again, they pretty quickly put him to death, like that he wasn't allowed to speak to the public. Before you know it, he's being put to death. And this is, like you said, as far as it being Clinton's like challenger moment, unifying the nation. Unfortunately, when terrorist attacks like this happen, like we saw after 9/11, the American people want blood, they want justice. And so the quickest way to sort of pacify that, or at least this is what they tell us, is like, let's bring this bad person to justice. Let's not let him speak his propaganda and you know, have a voice. We need to, you know, get justice right away. And so Timothy McVeigh was put to death very quickly. And we have not, of course, there's, you know, we can't hear from him now and find out what he was really told or what he really knew or what he believed was happening.
Yeah, great point. You know, for those of our audience who are new to this, like you mentioned, and who might not be familiar with false flags and might not even believe it, oh, that can't be true. I mean, we have a long, rich history in the United States of false flag attacks on the United States. And maybe you can just give our audience an idea of, you know, going back to the USS Maine, or, I mean, heck, people even believe Pearl Harbor, the information we had ahead of Pearl Harbor, and allowing that to happen. When you look at October 7th, fully aware that this was about to happen, you let it happen. You let certain things happen for a reason, and false flags can take on different roles. You mentioned people who are patsies, who don't even know that they're part of it. You could look at Operation Susanna in Egypt in 1954, when Israel hired some disillusioned Egyptian Jews to basically try to go into Cairo and start a war with Egypt. So you have a history of patsies, you have a history of different forms of false flags. But, you know, for our audience that's not really familiar, like, what is the goal of a false flag? Maybe you can, provide some detail on why would you want to carry out a false flag?
Sure. So I think that there's numerous reasons one might do this. And of course, I don't proclaim to be in the heads of these people, whoever they may be, behind these various operations. But I think we can sort of, if you understand this idea of problem, reaction, solution, let's start there. You know, you may have a problem that you either manufacture, you create, the actual see the problem, they say, hey, this problem's bad, they're having a reaction, and then you present the solution you wanted all along, right? It appears that often false flag events are the tactics that what I call the predator class will use to achieve their goals. If they can't just get it through politics, if they can't just get it through public, you know, campaigns and peer pressure and things like that, then they might use an event to keep people afraid. We know that fear is a great motivator. And if you allow a country to be attacked, or you make the attack happen, then all of a sudden people are clamoring to feel safe. And we saw in the post 9/11 era, that meant, okay, well, now we got to take our shoes off at the airport. You got to have body scanners. You could see, and I sort of referenced this in the documentary, that you had the underwear bomber, the shoe bomber, all these progressive alleged attacks, each of them, which are worthy of study and have holes and similar patterns here of multiple people being involved, different story, you know, just all the telltale tales of a false flag appearing after 9/11, but even before 9/11. You mentioned the US Maine, Pearl Harbor, definitely G. Edward Griffin. When I interviewed him for this episode, he said that he feels confident that if he had a day in court, he could prove to any jury that Pearl Harbor was a false flag. Now, the differences between some of these, in the community, there's sometimes reference to MIHOP or LIHOP. And MIHOP is made it happen on purpose and let it happen on purpose, right? And I don't know if any of us 100% know which one is which, but we often look at these events and it's like, okay, like you said with October 7th, clearly they let it happen. They let it happen on purpose. Intelligence was there. And you would say, well, why would they want their own people to be attacked? For the very reason we're seeing now, to justify going and achieving, you know, pushing people out of Gaza or whatever their goals are, right? So you have a problem, reaction, solution. And the other one would be made it happen on purpose, right? So you maybe the terrorists are funded by you, or, you know, you set up a patsy like Timothy McVeigh and you blow up a building, or you make it appear that way, right? And then again, you get to pass some new legislation, you get to push this, there's domestic terror in the air, American people now have an appetite for war. We saw that in the post 9/11 era. So I tend to look at these major world events. I don't think it's useful to just call everything a false flag. There are dozens upon dozens of examples. I've even seen people go back and doing the research on the Spanish-American War and elements of false flag tactics as far back as then. So this is a historical tool used by militaries. And I try to explain some of that in the episode as well, because the name itself even is just like, if I was I'm coming to attack you, I would fly a false flag, a fake flag of maybe an ally of yours. So you would assume from a distance, okay, this is, you know, friendly people, and then as closer, I attack you, right? So it's attack under false pretenses. Now, this term has kind of evolved to where we are now, where there's an attack on a nation or attack on individual, and it's blamed on one party, but that is a false flag being shown while the real perpetrators are hiding behind the scenes.
I don't want to put you on the hot seat here, I mean, as a journalist, but, you know, I think if you and I were having a beer and having a discussion about what you think actually happened on the morning of in Oklahoma City, what do you think actually happened?
I think there was a tactical team of I mean, I don't know the proper terminology, but let's just say some highly elite military soldiers, which McVeigh may have been connected to. He may have been a part of some elite unit that some of whom maybe knew what was going on, others who maybe have no idea. But of course, they're sworn to secrecy, non-disclosure agreements. You can be court-martialed. And a lot of these soldiers, again, at this level, truly, I think, believe in whatever it is they're doing. They're just, you know, kind of mercenaries at that point, and maybe don't care what the outcome was. So I think there was some sort of elite team that went in there with McVeigh, as we've seen multiple pictures and images of other men arriving with him and people leaving the buildings. Like there's some great books out there if people want to dive further into that. And these charges were already in the building. The explosive, the fertilizer thing may have never even went off. It might have just been a whole show. The explosion happens, the truck's there, you know, the truck gets exploded, and the fertilizer is just sort of a misdirection from the fact that there were explosives and charges in the building. And then again, after that, Bill Clinton gets to say, this is proof that there is the militia movement, domestic extremists. They signed the Domestic Terror Act in 1995, and the narrative advances further until 6 years later, 9/11 happens. So I absolutely believe this was some type of operation. I can't claim to know. Maybe it didn't come from Bill Clinton. It didn't come from the presidency. I do think that there is rogue elements of the U.S. government. Of course, the intelligence agencies operate pretty much without impunity, or with impunity, and they can do whatever they want. So perhaps somebody deeper within, not necessarily Bill Clinton himself, was leading this operation. And this, to me, would be similar to what I've seen with other operations, some of my other investigations into child trafficking and other things, where you have these very specific but compartmentalized units. And in the case of, for example, the Finders Cult, a rogue unit of the CIA involved in these kind of things, I think we could have seen a similar operation like that. So I don't want to claim Bill Clinton was behind it or something like that, of course, without evidence. But I do think some rogue elements of the U.S. government, most likely U.S. military intelligence, were involved in this.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And of course, famously, Bill Clinton was told he's not on a need-to-know basis about what was going on at Area 51. So you can imagine the level of security clearance that's even higher than the President of the United States. A lot of the time, these guys are just there. They're there for 4 years. There's a deep, you know, there's a deep permanent government in Washington that's going to be there for 30 years. Yep. Whether, you know, Bill Clinton's there or not, he's there 4 years, 8 years, he's gone. Amazing work. I, you know, I could talk about this all day. This is the this is like my weekend reading. You know, I'm sitting there reading a book on the USS Liberty over the weekend and reading about false flag attacks and understanding what NATO's death armies are doing across Europe. I mean, so I find it utterly fascinating. And I think you're right. I think people compartmentalize this stuff. I hope more people wake up to this. You know, we've been a big champion of trying to shine a light on child trafficking here on this show. And it is, to me, you know, the United States is the greatest purveyor of child sex trafficking anywhere in the world. How is that allowed to happen? How is the United States government facilitating this? And why are we not doing anything more about it? People, I think, compartmentalize, they shut down, they don't want to hear about it. But we need to. We need to shine a light on the darkest parts of our history, present and past, I would say. And Derek Brose, you're doing an amazing job as a journalist and great work on the new documentary series. I encourage everyone to go over to thepyramidofpower.net. We'll link it up in the show description so people can go through and take them in bite-sized chunks, watch 30 minutes, watch all of them, and I think you'll become, your eyes will be opened. Derek, great to see you. Thank you so much for your great work, and thanks for coming back to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Clayton. I appreciate it.